From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Okay, we journalists don't want to play the violin for our own business just because we're losing jobs, but like many other industries, media outlets are in free fall. Let's take a look at the media crisis. Traditional media outlets were struggling before the financial crisis hit. The internet transformed the way we get information and cut deeply into print, television, and even radio revenue. This year alone, an estimated 15,000 people lost their jobs at newspapers, according to the website Paper Cuts. Many black journalists have been cut out of the newsroom. Barbara Sierra is here to tell us more. She's the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, Farai. Good to hear you.
Yes, likewise. So overall, how are black journalists doing?
Well, so goes the industry, so goes African-American journalists across the country. And to a certain degree, we're getting hit a little bit harder. And that's unfortunate on so many different levels, not just because people are losing their jobs and their livelihood, but because of content issues. We worked very, very hard to get diversity in the newsroom, which is reflected in some ways in the content, and now we're losing that.
Now, what kind of stories are you hearing from NABJ members? Because I know you've made a special effort to try to take the temperature.
Well, we're hearing a variety of stories. We're hearing about long-term veterans being offered buyouts, which, you know, there's institutional memory that's draining out of newsrooms all over the country, both print and broadcast. We're hearing from people who are actually being victimized by union rules. They're credible, good journalists, but because of the rules associated with unions, they're the first to go. So it runs the gamut.
What about some criticism that I've heard from some black journalists that NABJ needs to do more or different, that there needs to be some you know, kind of muscle put into how NABJ addresses the industry? I don't even know precisely, I don't even think the people who spoke know precisely what they want, but what could you do differently?
I can understand the frustration, because when something this sweeping happens, you're looking for your associations and other organizations to just do something. But if it were simply about our membership, perhaps we would have a little bit more muscle. But what's happening in the industry right now is a little more broader sweeping. So what we're finding ourselves doing is working with publishers, network executives, to find out how we can soften the blow. The blow's coming. It's just a matter of degrees. So we're working that behind the scenes. We don't necessarily make statements in public all the time, because we do want to try to work with some organizations who are still interested in diversity but find themselves having to make the cuts.
What about the idea that the traditional industries are not going to be the places of growth? How much are you plugged into new media or just entrepreneurial ventures?
Well, that's something that we started trying to kind of cast that net a couple of years ago. And even before that, and under the old administration, what we wanted to do is just kind of grow that membership. And it's still, you know, we're still trying to attract that membership, because some of those folks who are involved in new media don't think that there's a place for them in a traditional journalism organization. So we're doing our best to bring them into the tent. That notwithstanding, we are providing professional development for our membership so that they can expand their education so that they can survive, because the industry is going down the tubes right now. But if I can veer off and into something else, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to be on your show, NPR, I'm extremely disappointed with NPR, because as content leaders, the more serious news listener turns to NPR, and for two shows, both geared, both headed by African Americans, it's just a shame, it's a travesty that these shows are going away. And, you know, I am interested in what NPR leaders have to say about what appears to be on the outside just an arbitrary cut.
Well, Barbara, it's great to talk to you. We appreciate you keeping track of the situation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Barbara Sierra is the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. She's also an anchor and managing editor for WTKR in Norfolk, Virginia. We have to move on to our reporters' roundtable. We're going to talk a little bit more about the media, but also President George W. Bush. He throws a lifeline to automakers, and President-elect Barack Obama ticks off some supporters with his choice of the pastor who's going to deliver his inaugural invocation. Here to talk about the week's top headlines, we've got John Yearwood, the world editor at the Miami Herald, and Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hello, Fry.
So, you know, we're canceled, but we're still here. So we're glad you're here. How are you guys doing this week?
Well, Tribune Company isn't doing that great either, so we're all suffering from the media earthquake these days.
All right. That's well, right. We're going to have a good holiday anyway. Let's move on to politics. President Bush announced this morning that the federal government is going to give $13.4 billion with a B dollars in emergency loans to General Motors and Chrysler in February. The struggling automakers are going to get another $4 billion. Now, the loans require that the car companies make major changes, show that they will once again be profitable. So, from your perspective, Clarence, what is the government achieving with these bailouts, and will it be successful?
Well, they're kicking the can down the road because this will be enough money in emergency loans to keep General Motors and Chrysler going for about until March 31st, when it will be President Barack Obama's problem. The main situation, well, you know, the big debate is just what's the best way to help the auto companies. That debate really hasn't changed, but obviously President Bush agrees with most Democrats that these firms involve too many jobs to be allowed to just go into bankruptcy and fail. But the long-term question of how do you help that industry still isn't answered.
Now, Chrysler announced that it's going to close all of its 30 North American manufacturing plants for 4 weeks. General Motors is going to close 20 factories, many for the entire month of January. So auto plants usually close for the holidays. These are extended closures. Do you think, John, that there's going to be kind of a Christmas miracle, for lack of a better word, and people will be able to go back to work earlier, or is that not something that you anticipate being on the table?
Well, Farai, one would hope that the announcement by the president this morning would give hope to a number of people. But I wanted to add to what Clarence was saying about it. It seems clear to me that what the president was doing, perhaps not elegant, but certainly a tap dance in which he wanted to make sure that none of the major automakers will file bankruptcy during his term. Wanted to make pass it down the road, kick it down the road so that it's something that Barack Obama would have to deal with. What's key, though, is what you were getting at is the fact that there are people in the middle of all of this and how they're going to be able to feed their families, how they're going to be able to spend the holidays. And that's where I think a lot of the focus need to be going forward.
This is a time when, you know, in this nation, not only do you have the massive job layoffs, but you also have a very strange situation with the American presidency, where you have an outgoing president who has really stepped back out of public life in some ways, and an incoming president who is all over the news. Do you think it's good or bad for the future of the Obama administration that he is de facto the person who gets the most airtime compared to the actual president? What do you think, Clarence?
Well, this is hardly a rewriting of the rules. This is how we do it in America, and this system was put together back in the horse and buggy era. Today, communication is so much faster, so revved up, that every day we journalists are asking, what you going to do next, President-elect Obama? And there's a new pressure on people. Also, Franklin Roosevelt, back in those Depression days, just had a strictly hands-off policy as he was coming in, even though President Hoover wanted him to join together in joint action to save the banks. Roosevelt also said, you know, one president at a time. And as a result, the Depression deepened, and the problem got much worse. So there is more pressure now on Barack Obama to at least show what direction is ahead. And I think on the whole, he's getting high marks for the way he is handling it. We can certainly see the stock market balance doesn't seem as severe as before, and the Fed is responding. I mean, you know, he seems to be doing a pretty good job of it under the circumstances.
All right. Well, John, what about some of these choices in terms of the cabinet? I just want to bring up one person. We've talked a little bit about Arne Duncan. What about the new Labor Secretary nominee? She is Hilda Solis of California, considered a liberal. She's from a Latino-dominated district. What do you see ahead from that nomination?
Well, clearly from some of the information we've seen out there, she's very much in tune with what labor wants. So we'll be seeing a lot of, you know, the desires of labor represented in some of the things that that she's pushing for as labor secretary, which is something that, as you know, we haven't seen for the last 8 years. So clearly labor is celebrating the pick. And if I can go back for a second to what you were talking about with Clarence, I think it's really important to say that one of the reasons why we're seeing so much of the president-elect and some people looking for him for leadership right now is because we're at a time of war. Not only that, we're also in the middle of an economic crisis. And I think that there's probably something to be said for the parliamentary system, which I grew up in, living in Trinidad, where the person who's elected becomes the leader the following day, the prime minister, so that there isn't all this time in the middle to have two separate heads of state, if you will.
Great point. And we are going to get more great points from you after a break. Clarence, John, stay with us. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back with our reporters roundtable. We've got John Yearwood, the world editor at the Miami Herald, and Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. So, guys, I'm going to move on to Rick Warren. Now, President-elect Obama has some supporters who are really ticked off. He chose Pastor Rick Warren to give his invocation at the inauguration in January. Now, Warren supported Proposition 8 in California. It's the ballot measure that passed and banned same-sex marriage in the state. Many of his gay supporters, some of whom raised a ton of money for the campaign, are incensed. Clarence, do you think this is going to cause some problems?
You know, it's interesting that Obama made this decision because he's had a long-standing relationship with Rick Warren, and I think that while predictably gay rights activists are going to be upset with Obama for including Warren, they're already upset with Obama for opposing gay marriage all along. He supports civil unions. He supports all other versions of gay rights, but he draws the line there, as did all the other Democratic candidates for president, the leading ones. And Rick Warren draws a similar line. I think what's interesting about Barack Obama is generationally, he's from a little younger generation than us 60s boomers. He is more of an outreach kind of guy, middle of the road, and so is Rick Warren among evangelicals. He's actually viewed as a moderate in their movement, which was a big reason why the two of them worked together to try to benefit from each other's audience / congregations, if you will. So I think this is a predictable dust-up right now that in the long run may actually help Obama.
John, Rick Warren staged and executed an incredibly high-profile event, which was a values forum. It almost was like a debate. It was one of these moments where you didn't have Senator Obama and Senator McCain face-to-face, but it was one of those landmark moments in the election. This is an incredibly powerful man. We've had him on. He said that he doesn't want to really interact with politics in a way where he is at all associated with any administration. But give me a little bit of your sense of who Warren is in the political atmosphere.
Yeah. Clearly, he's huge. And I think it was interesting. I watched that landmark discussion out in California. What I thought was interesting about that, a lot of pundits said after that the president-elect, Senator Obama at the time, did not do particularly well. So one may wonder, why would he want him at his inauguration? But it was clear that the president-elect has had a long-standing relationship with Rick. And I think what's also interesting about this is that it also brings more people to the inaugural table, if you will, on the day of the inauguration. A lot of people who feel deeply the way Rick does may not have seen any reason to get up and turn on the television set. This brings in some additional viewers to hear what the president-elect has to say. And if you look at his cabinet picks, it's clear that he wants to look at a much larger tent, and he has things to say. And I think this is an opportunity to get a number of different people who otherwise would not have been inclined to listen to his inaugural address to do so.
Let's take a quick look at one last topic, and this is getting a lot of heat. Senator Obama, or former Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, picked Hillary Clinton to be his Secretary of State nominee. And her husband, Bill Clinton, former president, has run a charity since he's been out of office. He released a list of donors yesterday who've given money. You've got Saudi Arabia and other foreign governments who've donated at least $46 million to the William J. Clinton Foundation. Blackwater Training Center was listed as a corporate donor. Some people are saying, as a married couple, she needs to be accountable for part of his actions if they don't like who his donors are. Clarence, is that fair?
Yes, it's fair. It's the thing is, there are going to be questions raised, understandably, about any relationship that a spouse has with overseas overseas governments and companies, or companies involved in anything that the Secretary of State is involved in. There are issues coming up regarding India and Pakistan. Will the Pakistanis perceive, justifiably or not, a bias for India because India gave a big load of money to Bill Clinton's foundation? Same thing with Saudi Arabia. Same thing with Blackwater. So I think these are legitimate questions. How they're going to be handled, I'm not quite sure.
Do you think this could possibly upend the nomination, John?
Oh, absolutely not. I think the senator has tremendous support on the Hill. And one of the things that that I thought was interesting about this is that we saw something similar after the former President Bush left office. He was he received a lot of money from the Saudis. He spoke in a number of capitals around the world. I don't think there was a lot of discussion made at that time that in giving money to his library, they were influencing his son. Which was the incoming president. So I think after a while we'll get beyond this. Certainly former President Clinton has talked about some different things that he will be doing far more so than any previous president to make sure that there's transparency. The question is whether or not that will happen. I don't think it's as much as what has happened in the past, but what will be happening going forward.
Well, gentlemen, have a great weekend. Great talking to you.
You too,
and happy holidays to you, Farai.
Yes, happy holidays to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with John Yearwood, world editor at the Miami Herald. He joined us from the studios at the Miami Herald, and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Black culture has spread across the globe. When you have hip-hop mixing with South Asian music, gospel with opera, black contemporary art with European classical art, you have hybridity. Cut-and-mix culture probably goes back generations, but the speed of media and technology has taken the meshing to a new high. Still, there are a lot of times when the global audiences and creators don't mix face-to-face, so we're going to take a look at why art and culture are blending, but the people in the audience may not be, unless they're asked to the table. With us, we've got Donna Walker-Kuhn. She provides marketing services to multicultural performing arts organizations. She's the president of Walker International Communications Group, and is Zolda Brillmeyer, a curator and writer in New York. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hi, Farai.
So, Donna, you have been promoting arts to multicultural communities for nearly 20 years. And so how do you – give me an example of something you do and the connections you try to make.
Of course. I probably will use the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater as an example. You know, it's their 50th anniversary, and we've had so much success with them on many different levels. But one of the things that I'm very excited about is our ambassador group. You know, one would think that, wow, well, the African-American community, why do you need to cultivate them for black dance? But in fact, you know, with every population we find, you know, everyone is looking for an invitation. And they want to make sure that they're welcomed at the table, that they're aware of what they're going to see, and how does this affect their lives? And so what we've done in some of our key cities, we have created a group of volunteers who dedicate an entire year to promote Alvin Ailey and then to promote to the groups that they belong to. And it continues to grow in the results in Chicago. We're extremely successful in Atlanta. We're doing a really great job. And we find that it really is the gathering. We meet once a month. It is setting the goals. It's looking at the tools, which are online tools. It's collateral materials, flyers and posters. It's appearances by the company. We kind of put it all together like a menu.
And then this and is you've even written a book that talks about your approach to it.
Yes, I have. I have. And I use that in several universities trying to develop the next generation to continue this work.
Well, Isolde, you're a curator, professor, and you focus on contemporary art produced in the last 15 to 20 years. So that's a big scope. What do you focus on?
Well, you know, Farai, and I actually really like Donna's notion of the ambassador. You're talking, Donna, about the ambassador group.
Yeah.
And in certain ways, as a curator working with contemporary artists, living artists, you know, I see artists as ambassadors within a very sort of global context. You know, I kind of have a feeling that we've moved from the era of the 1980s multiculturalism into a space of globalism that really kind of acknowledges this reality of diversity. So in terms of the exhibitions that I've curated, and I think I also take this approach in my classes both at Vassar College and Columbia University, it's really about a global mix, and it's about pulling artists from a range of different backgrounds and communities and stages, career stages, pulling them together in conversation around art, but also around ideas. So an example of this might be a exhibition that I did out at the Barry Art Center in New Jersey called Rewind, Recast, Review. And that was a small group show where I invited an American artist, a Kenyan artist, a South Asian artist, an Egyptian artist to take the idea of culture and history and rework it and represent it in whatever way they felt inspired. And culture, history, those are sort of, I guess, catchphrases that are somewhat universal. But by bringing in a global mix of artists, you're getting a range of different perspectives. And the visitor, and this is where I think, you know, like Donna, audiences are really critical. The visitor is bringing different experiences and sensibilities to the work, but is able to engage all of these different perspectives, all of this different artwork together in conversation, and is then sort of provoked to think about ideas from a range of different angles. And I really, for me, I feel like that's sort of the direction that mm-hmm. a lot of artists and curators and sort of the art world in general is moving.
Donna, you know, art art is something, some people say art is in the eye of the beholder. It's certainly something which can be personal or something that it can be a group experience. And a lot of times you deal with group experiences. You're dealing with clients like the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, Three Mo Tenors, the group who we've had on our show, the Apollo Theater. How do you think that Black audiences in particular view having a group experience that might take them a little bit out of a comfort zone? Like Three Mo Tenors is doing everything from gospel to opera to pop, and maybe taking some people away from their traditional musical experiences.
That is correct. And what we find is we try to create an environment for them, almost like a bridge from their house to the front door of the theater, so that one, they'll feel safe, they'll feel informed, and they'll be excited. So with Three Mo Tenors, we took the tenors to the community. We don't just wait for people to go and buy a ticket. We took them to churches. We took them to street fairs. We took them to presentations so people could see them, hear them, feel them. So that when we start promoting the sales, then that would be an organic response. Well, of course we want to come and see a full concert. They were at my church last week, or they were in my neighborhood last week. And we think that that's really very, very important. One of the things we also experienced when we worked on Margaret Garner here in New York with New York City Opera, the way we positioned this opera, which you know is a true story of a slave woman who murdered her daughter rather than have her brought up as a slave, we created a dialogue online, you know, so that people were talking about this. You know, would this happen today? What is the impact of this? Wow, as a mother, how would I respond? That created such an energy and buzz that it helped people form their own groups to come and see the show and then have a post-show experience. And so, yes, the group experience, I think, is critical in creating comfort for communities of color.
Isolde, tell me about, just really quickly, what can people do to encourage a group experience with art for people who are not used to it? You know, some people love going to galleries and museums. Some people don't. So what can you do to open the door?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I always try to keep in mind is that even, you know, when we talk about audiences and specifically Black audiences, I always like to speak in plurality, right? Because there's tremendous diversity among Black audiences.
That's right.
So as you're saying, you know, there are some among the audience that are not regularly engaging with the arts, and there are some that do it on a you know, regular weekly basis, if anything. And so I always sort of draw, there's a friend of mine who actively programs on the museum level, Sandra Jackson. She was with the Studio Museum in Harlem, and she's mm-hmm. now in Seattle Art Museum, and she's very much about this idea of curating experiences.
Yes.
And so I think for me, when I think about engaging art, and I think I'm speaking specifically about visual arts, the idea of curating an experience, you know, the idea of bringing audience, a diverse audience in, those sort of well, you know, kind of read and the newcomer into, say, a museum, a gallery, an art space, and really creating an experience for them, I think, is important. And you do that by kind of mediating their looking. And that may be by having somebody there kind of to provide a lecture and put things in context, by posing questions, by having materials ready that will sort of give each individual his or her own hook into the art that they're looking at. And then, of course, within a curatorial context in a museum or a gallery, you can provide multimedia materials, video, you know, computer screen, touch screen options. And all of that provides a range of different points of access for the diverse audiences that we are now very much seeing in art institutions. So I think that's something to really keep in mind in terms of programming. I mean, you have the actual curating, pulling the art exhibitions together, but then you have to program. You have to create
right.
an experience
mm-hmm.
for people and encourage them to kind of come in and really be engaged actively and consistently with the work.
All right. I know this is probably unfair, but we're close to out of time, but I want each of you to give me the name of, excuse me, of a work that you love. Donna?
Oh, my gosh, for Rye.
And Donna, you know, my area is sort of visual arts here, but I'm getting ready to go see Alvin Ailey, and I was just going to, you know, speak to Revelations and to sort of how that's become sort of an iconic piece within
right.
the context of within
exactly.
the context of Alvin Ailey, and very much visual in that way as well.
Great dance piece.
You know, it's a real challenge for I only because the reason I take on projects is because I love them. So it's not a question of one more than the other. But I am going to say my very first dance company that I ever performed with, which is called Nejwa Dance Corps in Chicago, that's still probably the dearest in my heart because that set me on the path that I now enjoy today.
Well, those are both great leads, and there's a lot of great art out there. So
yes.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Farai. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
We were talking to Donna Walker-Kuhn, president of Walker International Communications Group. She provides marketing services to multicultural performing arts organizations. And Isolde Brillmeyer, curator and writer in New York and adjunct assistant professor of art at Vassar College. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Biggie Smalls gets the silver screen treatment, while the Obamas get the drag queen treatment, courtesy of RuPaul. Plus, the Screen Actors Guild threatens a strike in the new year. Could that mean even more reality television? Here to help us get up to speed on the latest in entertainment, we've got Allison Samuels, national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hey, Allison.
Hi.
Always great to see you. So let's dive right in.
Mm-hmm.
Notorious. That's
yes.
the biopic about slain hip-hop superstar Biggie Smalls. And one of the things that caught my attention was that they held an open call
yeah.
For the lead actor. So mm-hmm. what happened?
They held an open call and, you know, they had all kinds of people come in. Nobody felt right. and then this guy whose name is Gravy,
that's
his rap name because he's a rapper, came in, and Biggie's mother was there, and she said, you know what, that's my son, because he looks so much like Biggie. He's sort of the same build, he has sort of the same mannerisms, and that's the part about watching the film. It's so scary, particularly if you met Biggie like I have, you're just sitting there going, wow. If you just do a double take, you're like, that's him on screen. It was amazing. Just the way he held the mic, the way he stood in front of the mic, all of it was so much of Biggie.
I have to say, I can't wait to see it. I got a chance to interview Biggie at one of the big awards shows, like 10, 12, no, it's more, longer than that. Anyway, I'm old, but anyway, a long time ago. And it was just, just to see that world.
Right.
You're in that world a lot more than I am, but just to see that world is very interesting. So Gravy.
Yes.
Was shot before a radio appearance. What happened after that?
Then he lost his contract, because he had a contract at that particular point with the record company to come out with an album. But then he lost that, and then he just sort of went back down south until somebody called him and said, look, you should really come up here and, audition for the Biggie role. And he decided, what do I have to lose since, I don't have my rap career anymore? And I can't imagine that this won't sort of send him to the next level as an African-American actor. And he had to gain like 45 pounds and all that other kind of stuff. So he went through a lot of physical sort of changes to make it work, but I think it's worth it. It's a great film.
Oh, what about the screenwriters? You've got Cheo Hodari Coker, Reggie Blythewood, black screenwriters. How, in general, not just them, but how are black screenwriters doing these days?
I mean, I think it's slow, but I think it's always been slow for African Americans. I mean, we've had our, good times, and they weren't really good times. They were sort of more where you worked a little more. But obviously, when anything impacts the industry, it's going to impact them even more because they weren't working as much in the first place. But when I look at a film like Biggie, I mean, the Notorious, that is sort of the kind of thing that doesn't come around a lot, which is unfortunate. But you just don't see it. But then, Reggie's wife directed A Secret Life of Bees. So you have sort of families that are sort of working together and sort of, out there doing their thing. But it's a select
group.
Super
couples.
Yeah, but it's a select group. You're only talking about a handful of African Americans that are getting that chance. And I think that's sort of the unfortunate part.
Yeah, and of course you've got Biggie's son, 12-year-old son, Christopher Wallace, playing his own father. Well, I want to move on actually to something that's a little lighter. RuPaul as the Obamas.
Yes.
You did a big cover story on Michelle Obama, and RuPaul has been on the drag scene for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, work, supermodel work,
right.
Getting a lot of money and a lot of popular acclaim. Sometimes just kind of in the more underground scene. And now, as the president and first lady, what's going on with that?
I wish I understood what was actually going on.
Describe it.
I mean, it's just sort of RuPaul, and because he's been trying to do a show for a while. And so finally he has this show where he will portray sort of both of them. One, because as a man, I've seen him as a man and he's very cute as a man. And then he looks fierce as a woman, so he's going to be able to sort of interchange those two guys. And I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. And it's perfect for him because I think he's been wanting to sort of get out there and do something that people will really gravitate towards. And I think people will be fascinated by. You have this great couple. Where it's just like the perfect opportunity for him to sort of show his skill as an actor. Because he's been making movies, he's been doing all kind of things underground. But now he has something where people will actually be able to see it on a regular basis. So
he's going to play both of them, not just once, but over time?
Over time, yeah. He's just,
goodness.
Yeah, and he's going to try to sort of see if it can sort of go on where he picks up from the news to sort of, portray different events that are going on with them. So I'm looking forward to that because I like RuPaul. So I think it's going to be really interesting.
It will be interesting. All right. What about the Screen Actors Guild strike? What does that mean for people who watch movies or people who make them?
I think, it's going to be a problem for us. I think, again, TV is going to become even more important. And I think TV was going to become important anyway because of the recession. I think a lot of people, because, it's really expensive to go out and see movies. So I think it's sort of a bad time in a way just because of that. But I think, yes, reality TV is going to sort of become even bigger than it already is. And you look at the shows and it's like, endless, the kind of shows reality TV-wise that are coming. And I think they sort of, they have everything in place for that to sort of work out.
You already had the writer's strike.
Yeah.
So are people kind of like just take the deal and shut up?
Yeah. I mean, in this economic time, yeah. They're like, you know, people are begging to keep jobs. People are sort of, you know, the auto workers, all that kind of stuff. People are having to really work hard to sort of to stay on track. So I don't know if they're going to get the sympathy that they would have gotten a couple of years ago. I think now people are like, if they're offering you something, you need to work it out. You need to find a compromise.
All right. Well, we will certainly stay tuned to the screen. Always great to get your perspective.
Thank
and
you.
To see you during the holiday season.
Yes. Merry Christmas.
Yes. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Kwanzaa.
All of it.
All of the non-denominational
yes.
holidays, equinoxes, you know, et cetera.
Everything.
All right.
Yes. This is all of those things. Yes.
Thanks, hon.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She joined me here in the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. He's played both God and the president. We're talking about Morgan Freeman, and earlier this month, the actor received Kennedy Center honors for his lifetime of contributions to American culture. Freeman may be a household name today, but fame came relatively late in his life. He was 50 when he got his first big break in the movies. He played a pimp named Fast Black in the 1987 film Street Smart.
So, how'd you do last night?
What'd I give you, $450?
Mm-hmm. Try maybe $550 or $600.
No, I give you all I got.
I take the bread. The whole loaf, you understand?
Yes.
You want money, you come to me. You try going into business for yourself, you'd be one dead.
Oh, not my face, please.
It's not your face, just my face. My and my.
The role earned Freeman an Academy Award nomination, and he parlayed the recognition into more than two decades of Hollywood success. Today, Morgan Freeman kicks off a News and Notes series called Living Legends. NPR's Tony Cox got a chance to ask Freeman about the character that got the ball rolling.
You have said that you're not going to play any more pimps like you did in the movie Street Smart, but you also acknowledged that that was your favorite character. So can you explain those two sentiments to us?
Yeah, I hope not to revisit any character. After I did Street Smart, of course, I don't know, it seemed that people thought that that was who I was. It's a trouble with playing a character and getting into some depth on the character. People say, oh, my goodness, that's what he does. So it's bad news for actors when casting agents and directors and producers say, oh, that's not his type of role. I think any actor can do anything. It's just, you know, give it a shot.
But you didn't have that experience when you played God, did you?
Well, I played God twice, remember?
That's true. But that's a different situation, is it?
I'm not quite so sure.
Oh, that's funny. One of the things that I read about you is that you're in the top five in terms of celebrity endorsers and the power of your name and the power of your voice. How much do your choice of roles, Morgan Freeman, factor into, let's say, your marketability, do you think?
You know what? Well, I have no idea.
Have you ever given it any thought at all?
I try not to get involved in that at all. You know, your marketability or your cue numbers or any of that. To me, it's just people talking.
One might say that you, speaking of the roles that you have played, and other actors have helped to pave this road that I will call, is something akin to Barack Obama has been described as being post-racial, meaning that when people see you or hear you or connect with you, they don't see black necessarily, they see an actor. And there are other actors who have achieved that, let's say. Are you aware of that? Do you agree with it? Do you disagree with it? Is it something that you even set out to try to accomplish?
Yes, to all of those questions. I'm aware of it. I've actually campaigned for it. I try. It's something I thoroughly and totally believe in. I remember when it first got started, this idea of open casting, that any actor could play just about any role. Now, of course, I wouldn't consider playing, you know, Benjamin Franklin or anything like that, but there are many, 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 many roles that are written without any, you know, it's sort of like accepted that this character is white, which, you know, thank heavens nowadays is not the way casting is done. So if we're ever going to get past this idiocy, we have to just sort of eliminate it as something to even talk about.
You won an Oscar in 2005, I think it was, for your role in Million Dollar Baby. But you had had a long and distinguished career both on stage and in films long before that. Do you think that award came late, or do you even care?
Don't care. I'm going to admit to the fact that had it happened the first two or three times, the first two or three times, it was all right not get it your first time out. That's never going to happen, particularly playing that kind of role. I was nominated for playing a pimp, and, you know, that's nobody's going to give you an Academy Award for that. But afterwards, I started to think, well, you know, an award doesn't really do anything more, but a nomination does do you something.
In what way?
Well, you've been classed with the best. So if that happens more than once, then, you know, it's like, okay, you got chops, you got some staying power, you got ability here. So that's, I think there are a lot of people who have won Academy Awards who just sort of did that and then gone away.
Morgan, how difficult, maybe difficult isn't even the right word, what is the impact of your living where you live, near where you grew up in the South, and commuting, as it were, to Hollywood and other places to do your professional work? Is it like living in two completely different worlds?
Yes. Yes.
You like it that way?
I like it that way. I live in a very rural setting on a farm with grass and trees and horses and dogs and birds and life. I decided that I had to have that because I was just got to the point where I couldn't no longer stand concrete. Living in a concrete cave, walking on concrete, no grass, no ground, not enough of reality about it.
But it must be a challenge, I would think, to have to go back and forth.
No,
I
mean, it's that's no challenge at all. You know,
no,
I mean,
kidding.
No, I've lived in New York City for 20 years or more. Almost 30 years I lived in New York City. I lived in Los Angeles, San Francisco, big cities. And so I think I travel easily between the two.
I read that you have had in your entire film career, Morgan Freeman, only one on-screen kiss. Is that true?
No.
How many have you had? Have you had a lot, or just, are we talking about two so I can still ask this question?
No, we haven't had a lot. No, I have not had, that many romances. I was married to Jane Alexander in Feast of Love. And in Street Smart, I kissed one of my women. But I can't think of anywhere else that I've been where this happened.
I want to go look toward the future a little bit and ask you about the Mandela Project and where that is. And I understood from something that I read about you that biopics aren't necessarily your favorite, and you felt you've been quoted as saying that in terms of portraying Nelson Mandela, that a fellow actor, Ben Kingsley, actually set the gold standard for doing these kinds of historic portrayals with his interpretation of God.
Right, exactly. And we can just move on down from that to Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash, Fox
as Ray Charles.
Ray Charles, Jamie Foxx. You know, this channeling of character. So the bar is set pretty high. And Mandela, being the person he is, it's a bit of trepidation that I approach it because I don't want to embarrass him or his memory.
You know, you have said Morgan Freeman, that this is a quote, "I cannot stand watching myself," end quote. And when I saw that, my reaction to that was, come on, you can't be serious. You're Morgan Freeman, great actor.
Well, no, I don't like watching myself.
Why? Why is that?
Hard to explain to you. I was on stage for a long time before ever getting into any situation where I could look at myself. So I only saw myself through the eyes of the audience. And so totally believable. Completely took the bait. Oh my, you're good. All right, I believe that. That's great. But if you see yourself, or if I see myself, then all I see is me. I used to see character. Now I just see me. So I don't like looking at it.
We're very clear that you are a wonderful actor and have had a wonderful career that I hope continues for as long as you want it to, which is for a while still, yes?
Yes, a while still. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Morgan.
That's NPR's Tony Cox talking with actor Morgan Freeman. He's one of the amazing living legends that we'll be putting the spotlight on in the weeks to come.